Alexander Melnikov playing Shostakovich's second piano concerto. Anthony Witt conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic. Written, says Melnikov, in traditional free movement concerto form, but each movement, he says, has the slight aftertaste of not belonging to the other two. Somehow everything is right, yet it is wrong. Could it be a joke, he continues, of course. And we listen to the first movement, initially dazzles with almost populist simplicity, but then even the smallest attempt to listen a bit more deeply, the first movement with its slightly wrong offset rhythms and harmonies, make us shift uneasily in our seat. Up from Melnikov's introduction to his critically acclaimed recording of both the first and second piano concertos of Shostakovich. He's back on the stage now, as Anthony Witt brings the Warsaw Philharmonic to its feet. Alexander Melnikov, born in Moscow in 1973. He was 12 when he made his public debut, playing Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto. Very heavily influenced as an artist by Sviatoslav Richter. Tatiana Nikolaeva gave an acclaimed last night performance of Shostakovich's second piano concerto in 1992. She, of course, very closely associated with Shostakovich, recorded his 24 preludes and fugues, as Melnikov has himself. He's back on stage alone this time. Bows to the audience and to the orchestra as he leaves the stage. Yes, that recording of the 24 preludes and fugues, released in 2010. Described by BBC Music Magazine as one of the 50 greatest recordings of all time. And to stamping and heavy clapping from the arena, he's back on stage for an encore. Yes, pulls out the piano stool and sits down. Feu d'artifice, fireworks from Debussy's Prelude, played by Alexander Melnikov, one of the first members of Radio 3's New Generation Artist Scheme back in 2000. His time on that led to several creative partnerships that endure for him to this day. Also introduced him to the world of historically informed performance. Plays forte piano a lot now. Back on the platform again, I have to say that encore listened to by lots of people standing in the aisles. Kept us waiting. But lots of people stopped in their tracks when he returned and sat down at the keyboard to play Debussy, making his Proms debut this evening, Alexander Melnikov. Well, that brings us to the interval this Friday night. Two works by Panufnik coming up, his Tragic Overture and Lullaby, and then we'll hear Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony. During the next 20 minutes, a Proms Plus discussion recorded just before this concert over the road at the Royal College of Music and introduced there by Andrew McGregor.
Here at the Royal College of Music, we're going to be finding out a great deal more about the two Polish composers in this evening's Prom, Witold Lutosławski and Andrzej Panufnik, with the help of my two guests. Panufnik's daughter and a successful composer in her own right, Roxana Panufnik, and Dr. Nicholas Rayland, who's senior lecturer in music and film studies at Kiel University with a particular interest in Polish music and film. So, Nick, perhaps you might give us a brief idea of the period in Polish culture and history from which this evening's music emerges.
Yes, the music in tonight's Prom comes from one of the most tragic and dramatic passages in relatively recent Polish history, the passage from the peak of World War II to the peak of Stalinism in Poland just over a decade later. So Panufnik's Tragic Overture, Andrzej Panufnik's Tragic Overture, composed in 1942, reconstructed after the war for reasons we'll probably come on to in 1945, is very much a wartime composition. There was then a brief period of relatively optimistic, albeit cautious optimism, and rebuilding in Poland after World War II. And some of the fruits of this period of rebuilding are a series of works Panufnik composed in 1947, including Lullaby, which is an extraordinary composition, as I'm sure we'll talk about as well. However, that progress, that rebuilding was about to be hijacked by Stalinist communism. And as the progressive socialist government in Poland gave way to a Stalinist communist government, the cult of the individual takes hold, and we move into a period when composers were asked to write socialist realist music, music essentially with a propaganda purpose to convert hearts and minds to the Stalinist version of communism. And Lutosławski's Concerto for Orchestra is very much a product of these times, and yet it's perhaps the only masterpiece to emerge from Poland during these times, and it's a work which both represents and transcends the circumstances of its production.
Now, Roxana Panufnik, the music we're going to hear in the second half of the Prom was written by her father in the 1940s, also revised in the 50s. Would you say it was typical of his musical language at the time?
His musical language at that time was going through a great state of change. I mean, we have to remember, despite all the hideous things they've been through with the Second World War and the Warsaw Uprising and then the communists coming in, he was still only in his early 30s. So he was still very much forming as a person as well as a composer. And but the sort of germs of the ideas that he then used as building blocks for the rest of his works, the rest of his life, were being born. And Tragic Overture is a great example of, it's the very start of him finding a four-note cell, a selection of four notes that he bases the whole piece on, with great imagination and variety, but keeping this little four-note motif going. And we see that develop throughout his works over the next 40, 50 years.
I was talking to you before we came on stage, and you were saying that actually, in some ways, you've been coming to your own father's music really rather late in life.
Yes, I'm very ashamed to say that I don't know much about his music at all, and this is for a few reasons. First of all, he died just as I was becoming an adult, and just as I was about to begin to really understand and empathize with him as a person and as a composer. I'd also been studying composition at the Royal Academy of Music, and there were a few snide remarks about nepotism and so on, and I purposefully actually avoided studying his music too much and knowing too much about his music, initially for that reason, and then as I was, over the last 20 years, particularly trying to develop my own personal compositional voice, I was worried about, you know, somehow his influence creeping in, which actually it has, because genetically I am wired to be like him as a composer and as a person. So now I revel in it, of course.
And now you're having to, well, listen to his music more anyway, because people are asking you for things for his centenary next year.
Yes, my whole year this year has been taken up with commissions that are in memory of my father, and I've just done this piece called Two Composers, Four Hands, which we might hear a bit about later, about it's an in memoriam for Lutosławski and my father, and it's about their piano duo during the Second World War, their underground duo.
Well, let's talk about that straight away, because okay. they were friends, and they played together as this duo in Nazi-occupied Warsaw during the war, and it must have had a huge effect on every aspect of their lives, Nick.
The war.
Yeah, and just the cultural conditions.
They didn't expect to come out of it alive. Mm-hmm. I think that's the first most striking thing to say. And Poles in this period were incredibly active and inventive in finding ways of keeping musical life and their idea of education going in a kind of black market of music and education beneath the Nazi radar. And it was a vessel for Polishness. Displays of Polishness were, of course, banned by the Nazis. But there were ways and means around this. The duo they formed was partly practical. It was a way of making money. Many intellectuals and musicians and artists were finding work in the cafe culture of the time, whether you were a doorman taking coats, having given up your philosophy position in the local faculty, or a composer playing in a piano duo. And they had this duo to make money, to help support their families, and also as a way of keeping some thread of their developing musicalities going in a public form. The cafes were essential in all kinds of ways. There wasn't much heating, there wasn't much coal, so people would gather in these Polish Warsaw cafes, partly for warmth and company, and to exchange gossip and rumour, and there you'd hear music such as Panofnika and Lutosławski's.
Now, the only thing that actually survives, as far as I'm aware, is Lutosławski's Paganini Variations, which was written for the pair of them. But what do we know about the kind of music they would play and sort of how adventurous they were?
It was an enormous variety of music. They were doing transcriptions of enormous 19th century symphonic works. They were doing jazz works, Gershwin arrangements. They improvised a lot, both in the style of jazz, but also in lots of different styles. And Nick was telling me earlier about how one of them would play the melody of a Schubert Lieder, and then the other would be improvising a sort of Ravelian accompaniment for it. It's the kind of stuff that you wish you were there, and it would be fantastic to try and see if there's anyone who could ever recreate it. But it was an enormous variety.
And there's no recording, is there?
No.
Sadly. Such a shame. What you'd pay to hear them actually doing this.
Oh, wow. Indeed. And the only surviving score is the Paganini Variations of all those many transcriptions, hundreds, maybe over 1,000 arrangements and transcriptions they produced. Lutosławski left with what he could in a handcart during the Warsaw Rising, the rebellion against the Nazis, and eventually the tragic defeat of the rebellion as the Nazis razed Warsaw before abandoning it to the Soviet Union. And he escaped with a few of his own scores and the Paganini Variations, and couldn't take the many, many, many other pieces that he'd written with Panofnik.
Now, we do find out quite a lot about Panofnik's feelings at the time through the Tragic Overture, written in 1942. And, well, it doesn't sound as though he held back at all on how he felt about life in occupied Poland.
Yes. There are two contrasting ways in which the Tragic Overture seems to represent wartime experience. One, Panofnik said, was essentially accidental or unconscious. The work includes, he realized when he heard it in performance, various what he called onomatopoeic sound, essentially orchestral effects mimicking life in wartime Warsaw. So one famous effect we'll hear is a long trombone downwards glissando about two-thirds of the way through the piece, which is the sound of a Messerschmitt disappearing into the distance and that kind of auditory Doppler effect as it disappears, he realized after writing the piece. There's also a powerful exchange of machine gun and artillery fire, he later realized, towards the climax of the piece, and then a final shriek of anguish at the very end of the composition. He realized these essentially programmatic elements had found their way into the music, slightly to his surprise. But it's also a piece which feels tragic in structure and tragic in terms of its musical drama.
If you look at the programme of the Tragic Overture, it says written 1942, reconstructed 1945. What happened to the music?
My father left Warsaw with his family, took them away at the worst point towards the sort of climax of the uprising to try and get them to safety. And, of course, they had to leave in a hurry. He left everything behind. And he tells the story of coming back to his old apartment after everything's finished and died down. And he gets there, and it's the place is a terrible wreck. There are fires burning in the courtyard. You know, people have chucked out. They've moved in like magpies and chucked the old residents' possessions outside. And he goes up to his apartment, and this strange lady is there. And he says, this was my apartment. And she says, yes. And he said, have you seen some scores? And she said, scores? What are scores? And he said, well, you know, the music, my music, this big pile of paper, manuscript paper with lots of music written on it. And I said, oh, that old rubbish. Oh, I threw that out. And he suddenly, it clicked, and he ran down to the bonfire in the courtyard. And there were little fragments of the scores on this bonfire. So he had to reconstruct everything. And it's amazing. I don't know how he remembered everything. And actually, for some of his more symphonic works, he wasn't happy with the reconstruction and just abandoned them and decided to move on altogether. But the Tragic Overture, I think one of the reasons why he managed to reconstruct that so successfully is because it's based on this very distinct four-note motif. And he probably could remember how he developed that and what he did with it and the atmosphere of it all. So
there's a structure which actually helped how the piece worked a second time. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other piece by Andrzej Panufnik we're going to hear in the second half, his Lullaby from 1947. Now, it was inspired by London, but before he actually came to live here. So what was the catalyst for the piece, Roxana?
Well, while he was trying to put all these orchestras back together, obviously a lot of the orchestral libraries had been completely destroyed. And he came to London in 1947 to get some more music, some more scores and parts for the orchestras back home. And he, one night at about 1 a.m., he couldn't get to sleep, so he decided to go for a walk around London, around the town, and everything was very quiet and very still. Be quite different now at 1 a.m. nowadays. But then in 1947, he found himself on Waterloo Bridge, and he was looking out at the water. And the water was moving in a very sort of steady pace. And And then the clouds in the sky were just very smoothly gliding across the moon. And he was thinking, gosh, you know, that moon, it's shining on Poland as well, isn't it? And he suddenly had this idea for this piece where there are two harps and 29 solo strings, and the two harps are representing the river, and there's a lovely, slow, very even pulsating rhythm, rocking rhythm throughout the piece, which stays the same. And then you have this amazing texture of all these solo strings in quarter tones, sliding chromatically through these quarter tones. And you can really see, you can feel that moment there with the moon sliding in and out of these clouds. And the moon is represented by, there are three solo instruments, the violin and then the viola and the cello play this beautiful Polish folk tune, which becomes the lullaby, and it sort of disappears behind the clouds and the sliding textures take over, and then it comes out again. And it's very atmospheric and very unusual.
And extraordinarily advanced, Nick, as well, isn't it? And didn't it turn out to have quite an influence on a future generation of Polish composers?
It was certainly in the back of the minds of Polish composers when, after Stalinism and the period of the Thaw, when gradually composers began to become more genuinely experimental again. There was certainly a memory. Panofnik's music had been banned in Poland by this point because he had defected by this point. But there was a strong memory of this piece which achieved a certain notoriety. And when you hear it this evening, you'll realise why.
We should talk a little bit about Lutosławski and how he came to terms with socialist realism and the impact it had on him, because he stayed and he had to find a different way of working with the system, didn't he?
Yes, he'd been stung by the system quite early on. His wartime composition is Symphony No. 1, and Symphony No. 1 is quite experimental. It's full of different styles, and he's pulling together into a symphonic vision. And the Vice Minister for Culture, Sikorski, a very powerful figure in Polish culture, as Stalinism came into play, said that a composer such as Lutosławski should be thrown beneath the wheels of a tram after the premiere performance in Warsaw of the First Symphony. So Lutosławski, yes, but he was being stung by the regime, but he also had to find a way of supporting his family, supporting his mother, and making his daily bread. He did compose some political pieces, and in later life, until he was somewhat older and more relaxed about talking about these things, he could sometimes be slightly disingenuous about whether or not he'd written mass songs to obviously political topics. A mass song, in Poland, if you haven't come across the term before, is essentially a militaristic choral pop song. And Lutosławski did write some on non-political subjects. There's one, a lovely one called I Should Marry. But most of them are on topics relating to the military, youth organizations, and there's a famous example called Nova Huta, which means new foundry, which is about an exciting new industrial development south of Krakow. And that's an example of the ways in which composers were coerced and pressured by the demands. He managed to steer away as much as possible from that kind of heavily tainted, doctrinally tainted work, by basing so much of his music of the period on the folk songs he'd already been working on in the post-war period. And so there's a series of works stretching from his folk melodies in 1945, his 20 carols, which are all based around folk melodies, in 1946, through to the Little Suite in 1950, the Bucolics in 1952, and most famously, Concerto for Orchestra, which he worked on between 1950 and 1954. And so his path through the mire was to focus on folk song. And this enabled him, essentially, to fashion compositional Trojan horses. Prokofiev once quipped that the thing that got denounced was formalism by the Stalinists, by the socialist realists, anything that was too complex. And Prokofiev said, basically, it was anything that a party official couldn't understand on first hearing a piece. Now, the last time I checked, that's a lot of stuff in most serious pieces that we don't fully understand on first hearing them. Lutosławski realized you could carry on all kinds of progressiveness in the accompaniments and the contrapuntal textures of your music if there was a folk melody or folk melody-like focus in the foreground of the music.
And we have Lutosławski's centenary celebrations this year. Your father's next year, Roxana. What are your hopes?
In the last sort of 30 years of my father's life, which would be the 1960s, 70s and 80s, he died in 91, I think classical concert audiences, a lot were rather scared off by contemporary music. While this was happening, my father was trying to find this perfect balance between your kind of intellectual development and structure of music, but the very heart and emotion of the music. And now, actually, his kind of music will be so much more embraced by concert audiences because it is emotional, it's passionate, it's warm, it's spiritual. And I want new ears to hear his music. And I hope your ears will enjoy it and take it away with you tonight.
Roxana Panufnik, Nicholas Rayland, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That was Andrew McGregor, and tonight's Proms Plus was produced by Rebecca Bean. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight the Warsaw Philharmonic make their Proms debut under outgoing artistic director Anthony Witt. Panufnik and Shostakovich from them very shortly. They are receiving lots of support this evening from members of London's Polish community. Georgia is somewhere out there in the arena, I think with a couple of Polish music lovers.
I am indeed, Petroc. Yes, I'm wedged into a corner of the very busy and rather warm arena floor here with two Polish prommers and one British one. The Poles felt they just had to be here this evening to hear their countrymen and women from the Warsaw Philharmonic play. Agata and Paweł. Agata, first of all, tell me, where are you from in Poland?
Gdańsk.
Gdańsk, and what about you, Paweł?
It just happened, the same city, Gdańsk.
Okay, so somehow we managed to geographically come across two Poles from the same place here at the Albert Hall tonight. Why did you decide that you just had to be here? Was it for the orchestra or the music that they're playing?
It was mainly orchestra. I never seen Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra before, so I really, really wanted to see them, especially in London, which is kind of strange and exotic in a sense, but very familiar in the other.
And what about you, Paweł? Was it just to see the orchestra or is this the music that just beguiled you here?
I was attracted to Lutosławski. I just wanted to take this opportunity to listen live interpretation of his music. He's such an important figure in the Polish and international classical music, so I thought it was great.
You wanted to hear his music. And I mean, there's a big focus on Polish music at the Proms this year, not just on Lutosławski, but Górecki, Paderewski, Szymanowski. I mean, we're really going for it with the Polish music this year. Do you think Polish music is really having a moment, that audiences are beginning to really realise that there's so much more than Chopin?
I think so. And I think also the Polish performers now feel entirely free to demonstrate what a artistry they represent and what a great composers we have. These composers that you mentioned, they've been on the forefront of the European classical music for many years, and now it is really showing through.
Agata, that Lutosławski that we heard in the first half, it's such a shining, crashing, amazing piece. It shows off the orchestra in so many ways, but it's also got these huge mood changes. It's wonderfully ecstatic one minute, rather melancholy the next. Does that say something about the Polish soul, do you think?
Definitely. We are unpredictable, like the music.
Like the music itself. Thank you so much for joining us. Back to you, Petroc.
Georgia, thank you very much indeed. So the platform is set, ready for Panufnik's tragic overture, written during World War II. Words of Julian Anderson, a brutal, overtly violent piece which was as direct a non-verbal protest against the Nazi regime as could be imagined. Anthony Witt conducts the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.
A wail of despair is how Andrzej Panufnik described the chord at the end of his tragic overture. His wordless protest against the horrors of the Nazi regime in Poland. Written in 1942, the Nazis, having closed down almost all aspects of Polish cultural life, allowed a few charity concerts for which Panufnik wrote that overture. References within it to several very popular anti-Nazi protest songs that Panufnik composed, not surprisingly, under a pseudonym, one of them Warsaw's Children, still remembered today in Poland. Well, a stage move now before Panufnik's lullaby. We've heard from the orchestra management, we've heard from the fans of the Warsaw Philharmonic. What about the players? Backstage now. Georgia? Are you there, Georgia Mann? Well, I hope we'll have Georgia Mann in just a second with a couple of the players as they leave the stage. Let me just tell you a bit more about Lullaby, though. Inspired by a visit to London, Panufnik had come here in 1947 to conduct and found himself walking by the River Thames. He looked down and saw the water underneath Waterloo Bridge. I saw dark clouds drifting slowly across a brilliant full moon. The river's flow and the night sky over the misty city prompted the idea of music, and the piece that resulted was Lullaby, which we'll hear in a few minutes. But let's see if Georgia's there now with players from the Warsaw Philharmonic.
Petrok, I have nipped back from the arena to the backstage corridor, right out of breath right now, right opposite the appropriately named Bull Run, which is the passageway leading on stage here at the Albert Hall. It's rapidly filling up with players from the Warsaw Philharmonic, unsurprisingly, just in between the Panufnik pieces we're hearing tonight. And I'm joined now by principal cellist Robert Potofsky and Daniel Kaminski, who is percussionist. Gentlemen, how has the Proms experience been thus far for you?
It's a great fun first time for us. Great opportunity to be here and just love it.
And how about you, Daniel? How's it been?
Very exciting. Great energy, great hall. And the fact that it's 119th, so it's very old, it's great.
How different is it, though, for you? Because your home in Warsaw is a smaller hall, of course, but I just wonder how it is in terms of having the audience this close to you. You've got the Proms up close and personal with you. Is it disconcerting having the audience so nearby? Is it a very different sound?
Yes, it is quite different, but it sounds surprisingly well. Everything, you can hear all the silence. Actually, the audience is very silent, you know, when you need it, and very enthusiastic when it's great.
And sometimes the silence is what you need. Thank you so much, gentlemen. We're looking forward to the Panufnik. Back to you, Petrok.
Yes, thank you, Georgia. And so the stage set, much smaller orchestra now, just strings on the platform from the Warsaw Philharmonic, ready for that piece, inspired by a nighttime walk in London. Panufnik recalled thinking that the moon that was looking down over London that night was also looking down over Poland, and so he incorporated into the piece the song of a Polish peasant. Radical work, this string orchestra divided into 29 individual parts, different tunings and simultaneous modalities. Lullaby by Panufnik.
Thank you.
Lullaby by Andrzej Panufnik, played by the strings of the Warsaw Philharmonic. Inspired by a visit to London in 1947, work that became a real turning point in Polish music, studied avidly by a new generation of composers, including Penderecki and Gorecki, led to a whole series of string texture pieces that became something of a hallmark of new Polish music. Panufnik found it hard to get it performed, though. After he defected to the UK, his music was banned and forgotten in Poland. There wasn't much interest in his works here either. Took a revival of Lullaby by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Oliver Nussen in 1998 to help it re-find a place in the musical world. Panufnik died in 1991, the same year he was knighted and posthumously awarded the Order of the Polonia Restituta, so finally recognised by both his home countries. Radio 3 at the Proms this Friday night, and to finish, the Warsaw Philharmonic are going to perform Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony, written in 1939. It's in three movements and was described by a bemused critic at the premiere as being a symphony without a head. As I suggested earlier to conductor Anthony Witt, the work must have confused early audiences.
This is true. Me too, I was confused, because actually the first movement is very deep, and then second is scherzo, and the third is also a little kind of scherzo. But maybe this tradition, symphonic tradition of Mahler, that sometimes you don't have such differences between movements like it was in Beethoven or Brahms.
Was there a conscious decision to pair two great Polish composers, Lutosławski and Panufnik, with Shostakovich? Were the links between Shostakovich and Lutosławski?
The most important is maybe that actually they all composed a little at the same time. Shostakovich was a little bit older, and also important part of their life and the whole life on Shostakovich, it was in the communist regime. And actually the pieces we perform of Lutosławski and Panufnik were written also in that period.
You remember this period yourself.
Sure.
Of course, where music must have been perhaps even more important than it is today in terms of representing freedom, of representing the idea of universal culture.
Yes, and not only music. I think in Poland and theater and movies, it was more important than now, because people wanted to express some ideas which they were not able to express directly with words.
This is your Proms debut, so therefore a very exciting evening, but also rather a sad evening, because it's the last night that you will conduct this orchestra as its artistic director.
Yes, but you know, I have been for 38 years a music director of four different Polish orchestras, among them two most important Polish radio orchestra in Katowice and Warsaw Philharmonic. So I'm a little happy to have this kind of job behind me.
Anthony Witt, who next season becomes honorary conductor of the Krakow Philharmonic. Very important for me, he says. I was born in Krakow and studied there. Well, after that small string orchestra for Panufnik's lullaby, back to full-size Warsaw Philharmonic in place now for Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony, and just been tuned by Ewa Marcic, their leader. So for the last time, back onto the platform with terrific energy, Anthony Witt bounds to the rostrum to conduct Shostakovich's Symphony No. 6.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Anthony Vitz conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra in Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony. No risk of him having his head down in the score, because there wasn't one. The conductor's music stand cast away. Here he comes back onto the platform again at the end of his tenure as artistic director and chief conductor of the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra. Bringing now players from the woodwind section to their feet. Such burlesque at the end of such a solemn symphony might be something to do with Shostakovich's passion for Offenbach's music. He and his friend and confidant Ivan Solotinsky loved Offenbach. Solotinsky rated him as a satirist on a par with Aristophanes, Voltaire and Swift. Shostakovich perhaps yearned various points in his life to create a spoof on the Politburo. The closest he came was his 1959 operetta Cheryomyshki. Pauline Fairclough puts it in the Proms programme note tonight. In the finale of the Sixth Symphony, Stalin's famous statement of the 1930s, life has become more joyful, was never more brilliantly satirised. Well, the orchestra on their feet. Much applauding and stamping and cheering from the audience. I'm sorry to say, still, unless there's one directly above me, I still can't see any red and white Polish flags being flown this evening here at the Royal Albert Hall. Anthony Vitz returns to the stage again, reflecting, I wonder, on a long role in Polish music making, more than half a century. Conducted Lutosławski's Concerto for Orchestra with this ensemble 45 years ago for the first time. Well, there is something traditional about an orchestra on tour giving their foreign audiences an encore, and I think the Proms are rather hoping that they're not going to be disappointed. Anthony Vitz returning to the platform again with baton in his hand, which is a hopeful sign. The Gavotte from Prokofiev's Symphony No. 1, keeping the Russian theme going in this prom, from the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra and its outgoing music director, Anthony Vitz. Next season, he becomes music director of the Navarra Symphony in Pamplona in Spain, as well as I mentioned, honorary conductor of the Krakow Philharmonic. Very important to me that, he says, for I was born in Krakow and studied there. first came to notes when he was second prize winner in the Herbert von Karajan competition. Became his assistant and also spent time studying composition with Penderecki and with Nadia Boulanger. Back on the platform again. Well, having given something Russian, there was no way he and his orchestra were going to get away without something Polish, the polka from The Little Suite by Lutosławski. Anthony Witt conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra, bringing to a close their first performance at the BBC Proms, his Proms debut as well, his last concert as artistic director of the orchestra. Jacek Kaspczyk will take over from him next season in Warsaw. Well, that has got a busy bank holiday Proms weekend underway. It continues with Lutosławski in Britain tomorrow afternoon at Cadogan Hall, 3 o'clock on Radio 3. Then the Mahler Chamber Orchestra tomorrow night. Packed programmes on Sunday and Monday as well. Full details at the Proms website. Every Prom live. And if you haven't been catching up on our TV Prom coverage, much there by the iPlayer. And Stephen Huff, Daniel Hope will be amongst Katie Derham's guests on Proms Extra tomorrow night at 7. So, as Anthony Witt leaves the stage for the last time and his players head home with him with exciting memories, doubtless, of this first Proms appearance, time to bid you good night from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you very much. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall, and I'm sure I can't be alone in hoping that the Warsaw Philharmonic will be back at the Proms before too long. Just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom here on BBC Radio 3 next Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, of course, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every Prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. Well, Petrock mentioned tomorrow's Prom. Sunday's Prom takes up half to the afternoon as well, which, of course, can only mean one thing.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Wagner's Parsifal. Lars Klavermann, John Tomlinson and Katharina Dalyman star in Wagner's final epic drama of renunciation and redemption. Mark Elder conducts the Halle in Parsifal. Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 at 4:30.
Well, back to this evening, and in 5 minutes, our feature, the Reverend Richard Coles, continuing his series exploring the idea of sin. Jean-Yves Thibaudet is the soloist taking up the challenges of the Ravel G Major Piano Concerto in tomorrow night's Prom, and here he is now in Debussy, the Tarentelle Styrienne. Thank you. Debussy's Tarentelle Styrienne, sometimes called Just Danse, played there by Jean-Yves Thibaudet, and he joins the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra for the Ravel Piano Concerto in G in tomorrow night's prom. Surrounding the Ravel, Wagner's Rienzi Overture and Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. That's at 7:30 at the Royal Albert Hall and live here on BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15 and now our feature. During this week, the Reverend Richard Coles has been exploring the idea of sin. Well, in this final programme in the series, he turns his gaze towards the light and the many modes and mechanisms that mankind employs in search of redemption.
If you go to India, you can hardly avoid pilgrimage sites. And it's really extraordinary to feel yourself to be on pilgrimage, to feel yourself to be part of this extraordinary journey with the hope of a real change into someone new at the end of that process.
Dr. Jessica Fraser, a fellow of the Oxford Centre of Hindu Studies.
It reminds you that the tradition of pilgrimage is alive. It reminds you that people still do go through great suffering, great effort to try and become a different person, to become a better person, from whichever perspective they see that.
Trying to become a better person. Well, one way you can, I suppose, help in that is through your own efforts. And pilgrims to Lincoln Cathedral, especially to see the Shrine of St. Hugh, would have been required to make quite considerable efforts because it stands at the top of what is rather literally called the Steep Hill. You climb up this, and part of the way you would demonstrate your commitment to the penance and reparation necessary to expiate your sins would be through physical suffering, physical labour. There are various ways you could ascend this hill in ways which would demonstrate precisely that commitment. Now, of course, you have many opportunities to stop on either side and buy gewgaws, knick-knacks and a cappuccino. Lest we stumble ere arrival, I think we may permit ourselves a sustaining beverage. Now, we've established so far in this series that pilgrims toiling up Steep Hill, barefoot or on their knees, or in sackcloth and ashes, would have felt burdened by their sins. This is something more than guilt, though that would be part of it. And according to Paul Gilbert, Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Derby, something more than shame.
Guilt is associated with harm doing, and this is related to the evolution of caring behaviour. So guilt actually motivates us to feel sad and sorrow, whereas shame isn't about sad and sorrow. Shame is about anxiety, fear and depression. And we focus not on ourselves, which you do in shame, but on the harm that we've done the other, and then we want to repair it, make amends, put things right. So in shame, the focus is primarily on the self, either what you're thinking about me or what I'm thinking about me, whereas in guilt, the focus is primarily on your behaviour and the feelings of the other person who has been hurt by you in some way.
The language we use to describe this predicament is rich in metaphor, borrowing from the lexicon of labour or commerce to get a sense of the dynamics of redemption, the easing of our burdens, the discharge of our debts. Those dynamics are the subject of this last programme about the idea of sin, and we begin in Lincoln, for medieval pilgrims an important staging post on the way from perdition to salvation. And it's an important staging post for me too, for here I was ordained priest and charged solemnly to search for God's children in the wilderness of this world's temptations, to call them to repentance and to declare in Christ's name the absolution and forgiveness of their sins. We're at the top of Steep Hill. There, of course, stands the cathedral, and we're right outside the West End in what looks like a very traditional English cathedral close. And I'm here with the precentor, Canon Gavin Kirk. But Canon Kirk, I guess what we're seeing now is not what a medieval pilgrim would have seen.
No, indeed. It's probably rather quieter than it would have been in the medieval period, when there would have been several dozen, if not more, clergy attached to and very busily working around the cathedral to service a large number of pilgrims who would have been, like you've just done, toiling their way up Steep Hill and making their way into the cathedral for a number of reasons.
And very hard to describe the sheer majesty of the West Front of Lincoln Cathedral, even to us who've probably seen dozens of West Fronts of cathedrals. But to the medieval pilgrim, presumably this would have been an extraordinary experience.
And particularly the way that it would have appeared to the medieval pilgrim, because it would have been brightly coloured. At the moment, it's all pretty much one tone of stone, but it would all have been painted. There's a medieval frieze running across the front of the cathedral, and on the left-hand side, as you look at the west door, you can see the torments of the damned, and on the right-hand side, you can see the joys of the blessed. And those two alternatives for the medieval pilgrim were very, very starkly portrayed.
So, as you entered into the building, you were entering not just a building, but you were also entering into a narrative of your own salvation or indeed damnation.
Very much so, and the opportunities ahead of you were starkly portrayed.
Sin can be seen in the broader picture as the first stage in a transformation. You sin, but ideally you then see why it's bad to sin, and you yourself are transformed into an improved person. And we see ways of doing this in various different contexts.
Dr. Jessica Fraser, throughout these three programmes, has been our guide to sin beyond the boundaries of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Hinduism, for instance, has a notion of purification. And there are rituals that you can do to try and purify yourself of the effects of sin. Interestingly, those rituals often are about transforming your very self. They're about literally purifying your being so that when you come to act the next time, you will be a changed person.
And one of the greatest Hindu festivals is happening in India right now. The Kumbh Mela takes place every 3 years when millions gather to bathe in the waters of the Ganges. And that suggests that this is a washing away of sin.
Now we've done our bathe.
We caught up with the BBC's veteran reporter, Mark Tully, at the Kumbh Mela.
One of the reasons given for Hindus assembling in huge numbers at the place where the two sacred rivers Jamna and Ganges meet at the time of the Kumbh Mela is because this is said to be a specially auspicious time to wash away your sins. Now that may sound as though they're doing something like Christian baptism, but actually it's nothing like that. Because the Hindu view of sin is quite different to the Christian view of sin. The Hindu view of judgment is quite different to the Christian view of judgment. And the Hindu view of redemption really is that almost there is no such thing as redemption. You have to work off your own sins. I'm crossing the river with one of India's important religious leaders, Swami Chittanandji, and he's going to take a bath in the Ganges. But he is not going to wash away his sins, or so he tells me.
I have a faith. I love my mother Ganga. I am just going to sit in her lap. That's it. Because I have a connectivity with her. I am not here to wash my sins or give it to her. Not at all. First of all religions are wonderful, beautiful and great. But everyone has their own way to give people their ways to live in their lives. So first of all these religions, Abrahamic religions, mostly they say that you are basically a sinner. Now when you become a sinner, now you are all the time thinking of time, I have to get rid of these sins. But here, from the day one, yes, pap and punya, the sin and merits are here also. But basically when you come, they say you are not a sinner, you are a divine. And when you are a divine, means you are the part and particle of the divine. If he is divine, you are divine, because you are Amritasya Putraha. You are the nectar of that divine nectar, and you are the part of that nectar. If that nectar is divine, this nectar is divine, because you are a part of that nectar, you are part of that ocean.
So for Swami Chittanandji, we're not all miserable sinners. We're not full of original sin. We are actually full of God. But that doesn't mean we don't misbehave or we don't commit sins. Yes, we do commit sins, but we'll have to pay for them ourselves.
As Mark Tully observed, ritual washing is very important in the Abrahamic traditions. In Christianity, the purifying effects of water are made explicit in the liturgy of baptism, which connects our own need for a wash to humanity's need, occasioned by the sin of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. When they took and ate the forbidden fruit, they not only initiated the doctrine of original sin, but also one of the greatest poems in English literature, Milton's Paradise Lost.
Earth trembled from her entrails, as again in pangs. And nature gave a second groan. Sky lowered, and muttering thunder, some sad drops wept at completing of the mortal sin original.
If we're thinking of original sin as with a capital O, capital S, peccatum originale in Augustine's Latin, that does have a distinctive Christian ring to it because it's essentially the coordination of Adam's sin with Christ's act of righteousness.
Professor Gary Anderson, author of Sin, A History.
It's there in Paul's letter to the Romans, the 5th chapter, the comparison of the sin of Adam to the righteousness of Christ.
For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous.
Augustine is certainly the person who gives the idea of original sin the sense that we generally think of, that is, the notion that sin has compromised radically the character of human free will. It's not there in the clearest fashion in Paul, and certainly isn't there in the Church Fathers prior to Augustine.
And yet this fundamental teaching in Christian doctrine is found in neither Islam nor Judaism. Rabbi Rebecca Burke.
Rabbinic commentary on the story of Eve is fascinating because whilst there is some rather misogynist texts that like to blame Eve and to put everything in the court of the women, actually there's also some rather interesting texts that suggest that Eve was doing the right thing, suggests that Eve's quest for knowledge and for full revelation was something that led human beings out of Eden in a positive way. Eden is not somewhere that we refer to as somewhere we want to return to be out of the way of temptation.
So no prelapsarian ideas such as we have so powerful in Christianity.
Not at all. Not at all. There's a new Jewish primary school in London that took the name Eden, and there was a great deal of discussion about why Eden, because there is no sense of yearning for the Garden of Eden again. That sense of knowledge that came from temptation is something we feel good about.
Well, it is precisely the Genesis story with its parallels in the Quran that is read in a different way, because in the Genesis story, to some extent, the fall is about the fall of man.
Scholar and broadcaster Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Islamic and Interreligious Studies at the University of Edinburgh.
In the Quranic narrative, it's very much the fall of Iblis, who becomes then the accursed Satan for his disobedience. So yes, Adam does disobey when he eats from the forbidden tree, but actually it's the fact that Iblis is the one who refuses to bow in front of Adam when God orders him to. And for this, for his arrogance, he is banished from paradise.
And that means that there is no sort of take-up in Islam of a sort of post-Augustinian notion of the taint of original sin, and that the sin of Adam is one that stains all his descendants.
No, absolutely not. And in some ways that's a huge contrast because, yes, we are not born into sin, and we can... You know, I would argue that there's no nihilism in Islam. You can work for your own salvation, even though ultimately it all lies within God's power and God's grace. But not all Muslim philosophers saw Adam's disobedience as a major transgression or as a loss. And one of the famous Indian Muslim philosophers, Iqbal, said that this really was the first kind of flash of consciousness. This was Adam waking from a dreamlike status, which he had before he ate from the tree, to now realizing that all human activity now would be based on moral choices. So therefore, it is that freedom that we are given and the freedom to act based on moral choices that has been God's biggest gift to us.
Mona Siddiqui. There is the idea of the felix culpa, the happy fault in Christianity, which rejoices in Adam's fall, for it made possible our salvation in Christ, the second Adam. And that rescue is effected through baptism.
My parishioners, if they come to us for baptism, get baptised in a font that dates from the 12th century, a much hacked around piece of stone that was done over by the reformers, but is restored to its place of glory near the west door of my church. But if you were a Florentine, you might come to the Baptist.